KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I think millions of people would lose coverage, and millions of additional people would lose access to needed care as a result.
Republicans say Medicaid cuts are off the table, but their budget suggests otherwise.
It's Monday, March 10th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, what is the government's justification for arresting a Columbia University student?
He has a green card and he'd been organizing pro-Palestinian demonstrations.
The government bears the burden of proving the reason that this person is deportable from the United States.
Also, after President Trump refused to rule out a recession, the stock market tanked.
And later, dreams of jumpstarting the tech industry in Syria.
And the value of teaching classic songs to younger generations of birds.
The more older birds that you have in a population, the more songs young birds can learn from.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A major development in Syria, Kurdish forces who've controlled part of the country for more than a decade are now agreeing to be incorporated into the Syrian state. NPR's Jana Raff has more from Damascus.
U.S.-backed Kurdish forces have agreed to give up control of northeastern Syria. It's territory they've controlled since breaking away from the former regime in 2012. The leader of the Syrian Democratic Forces agreed with Syria's new president that the Kurds would hand over control to the central government of security, borders, and oil and gas fields. In return, the Syrian state guarantees Kurdish rights as Syrian citizens. The semi-autonomous Kurdish-led region has been under intense pressure, including from the U.S., to integrate within the new Syria since the fall of the former regime last December. Jane Araf, NPR News, Damascus.
A federally funded database helps track long-term missing person cases, yet an NPR investigation finds even in two states legally required to use it, more than 2,000 people have not been at it. More from NPR's Jacqueline Diaz.
There are tens of thousands of people in the United States who are considered long-term missing cases. Those are people who go missing and stay missing for more than 1 year. NAMIS is supposed to serve as a tool to help find those people. The system pulls info from police, families, and medical examiners. 16 states have laws mandating the use of NAMIS in some way. But an NPR investigation found that about half of all law enforcement agencies in the United States are not listed in the NAMIS system. And NPR found that in Washington and New Mexico alone, two states legally required to use NAMIS, nearly 2,400 missing people were not listed. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
A Wall Street sell-off that began last week accelerated today over worries about the effect of Trump administration tariffs on both U.S. consumers and the global economy. Adding fuel to the fire was an interview over the weekend in which President Trump refused to rule out the prospect of recession. Matthew McGuire is a former executive director of the World Bank and an expert on international development. He says average Americans are concerned.
Consumers are 70% of our economy. So as more and more people worry about losing jobs, as more and more businesses are worried about increasing costs that consumers are going to have to pay for, there are a lot of people who are very worried right now about where we're headed.
The White House issued a statement tonight saying since Trump's election, industry leaders have responded with, quote, trillions in investment commitments that will create thousands of new jobs. Since its high point after the election, the S&P 500 has lost more than $4 trillion in wealth. The Dow fell nearly 900 points today. The Nasdaq was down 727 points. This is NPR. The Los Angeles District Attorney says he doesn't support the resentencing of Eric and Lyle Menendez. DA Nathan Hochman saying today that brothers have repeatedly lied about why they killed their parents at their Beverly Hills home in 1989. The brothers are serving life terms without the possibility of parole. Hochman said last month he opposes a new trial for them. His predecessor had recommended the brothers be sentenced to 50 years to life. That would make them immediately eligible for parole. Resentencing hearing is slated for later this month. As marijuana becomes legal in more states, more people are using the drug and millions are doing so before driving. As NPR's Meg Anderson reports, police are grappling with how to prevent people from driving under the influence.
Studies show THC, the chemical in marijuana that makes you high, can impair driving. But THC can stay in your body for hours or even days, so it's hard to know if someone was high when they got pulled over. Police are searching for a tool that would work as well as the alcohol breathalyzer. They're piloting THC breathalyzers, saliva tests, even goggles to measure a person's pupils. Jordan Wellington, a consultant who works on marijuana policy, says there's also a role for the public to police themselves.
If people wouldn't get on the road when they're impacted and unable to drive a car, we wouldn't be as worried about how to assess them.
Meg Anderson, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices followed the general market lower today. Oil was down a dollar a barrel to $66.03 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. House Republicans have to get their spending bill passed by Friday to avoid a government shutdown. They can likely afford to lose just one vote, and that's the easy part.
Then they'll have to get working on their plan to extend $4.5 trillion in tax cuts passed under the Trump administration, a plan that will require huge cuts in government spending. Republicans are adamant that cuts to Medicaid are a non-starter. Here's House Speaker Mike Johnson on NBC's Meet the Press last week.
Are cuts to Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security off the table?
Yes, and don't take my word for it, Kristen. Go do a word search of the budget resolution that we passed on Tuesday. There is not one mention of Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security.
But the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office released a report last week that said the Republicans' budget likely would require cuts to Medicaid or Medicare. To explain the math on this, we're joined by Edwin Park, a health policy expert at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so technically speaking, it is true, literally true, what Speaker Johnson said, that the budget bill does not mention Medicaid anywhere. It tells the House committee, which has jurisdiction over Medicaid, that's the House Energy and Commerce Committee, it tells that committee to find $880 billion in cuts over the next decade, right?
That's correct.
And just very simply, let me just ask you very directly, can it do that without cutting any federal funding for Medicaid?
It cannot unless you're cutting Medicare, and both Speaker Johnson, other House Republican leaders, and President Trump have said that they do not want to cut Medicare. So if you take Medicare off the table, Medicaid constitutes 93% of all mandatory spending that remains under the jurisdiction of the Energy and Commerce Committee.
Okay, well, that argument has been floated, but Republicans say that they can cut spending without cutting any benefits in either Medicare or Medicaid because they're going to do this by eliminating waste and fraud. Is there $880 billion worth of waste and fraud in the system?
Simply no. If you look at the major Medicaid cut proposals that are under consideration, they're the same proposals that were included in the failed 2017 repeal and replace plans. And they all involve major cost shifts for the cost of Medicaid onto states, because of the federal government and states sharing the cost of the program, making it harder for states to finance their share of the cost of Medicaid, or imposing more red tape on those who are already working or who aren't able to work because
they're disabled, have chronic conditions, they may be caregivers or in school.
Just to get back to fraud for a moment, Speaker Johnson has talked about how there is about $50 billion worth of fraud in Medicaid each year. Is that an accurate estimate?
It is not. What he's trying to do is equate a measure that's used in the federal government to assess improper payments, but he's trying to equate these improper payments as fraud. And the vast majority of improper payments are not because the payment shouldn't have been made, but there were some errors in terms of the documentation related to that payment, or errors in terms of some of the procedural steps that were taken in making those payments. But there's no finding that that was actually fraud or even payments that should not have been made.
Hmm. Well, $880 billion would be something like what? An 11% cut to federal funding for Medicaid, right? So like, however that cut of $880 billion happens, what would it mean for Medicaid if we see more than a tenth of the federal spending on the program eliminated?
I think millions of people would lose coverage and millions of additional people would lose access to needed care as a result. Many of the proposals that are being considered to achieve this $880 billion target involve shifting costs to states or making it harder for states to finance their share of the costs of Medicaid. So states are essentially left holding the bag. They're going to have to make the painful choices in terms of cutting eligibility, cutting benefits, cutting payments to providers like hospitals and nursing homes that serve Medicaid beneficiaries. And in fact, that's one of the reasons it's politically attractive to some federal policymakers is because they're not explicitly cutting Medicaid benefits. They're making states, legislatures, governors have to make the politically painful choices that they'll have no choice but to make in light of these massive cost shifts that they could face.
Edwin Park with Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy. Thank you so much for making this so clear.
Thank you for having me.
Mahmoud Khalil, a recent graduate of Columbia University, was arrested over the weekend by immigration officers. Khalil was one of the pro-Palestinian student leaders active in last year's protests against the war in Gaza. Late today, a federal judge in New York blocked any efforts to deport Khalil until a court hearing on Wednesday. NPR's Ximena Bustillo is here to tell us more. Hey there.
Hey.
Hey, so start with the why. Do we know why, like on what basis Khalil was detained?
President Trump directed the government to use all of its tools to punish those who have engaged in, quote, anti-Semitic harassment and violence. The executive action cites the federal law that authorizes deporting a foreign national who, quote, endorses or espouses terrorist activity. Homeland Security spokeswoman Tricia McLaughlin said that Khalil had been arrested in support of this action and that Khalil had, quote, led activities aligned to Hamas, a designated terrorist organization. In a post to social media earlier today, Trump said that this was the first of many arrests to come.
Now, I want to ask about his immigration status, because I get how this might work for someone on a student visa, a temporary visa, but Khalil was not. So how can he be targeted?
Right. Khalil was of Palestinian descent and has a green card. Green cards are also known as lawful permanent residency, and they allow people to live, work, and travel as a U.S. citizen would. They are considered just a step below citizenship.
Right.
Khalil's lawyer said that ICE officers told him that his green card was revoked, but that's not quite how it works. Lawful permanent resident status can be revoked for committing crimes such as aggravated felonies, possession of drugs, fraud, or other crimes. But Kelly Stump, president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, said that that is now up to a judge for decision.
The government bears the burden of proving the reason that this person is deportable from the United States. And then just depending on what ground we're looking at, that's how where the fight ensues.
This process takes time. It can be years before someone gets a court hearing, and there's multi-million case backlog in immigration courts.
Million of case backlog. Okay, so that is a lot. Do we know where he is now? What might happen to him in the meantime?
We know that over the weekend, Khalil was transferred to an ICE detention facility in Louisiana. His lawyers had told NPR that they're going to fight for his rights in court. Morgan Bailey, who's a former U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services official, said that it's possible that Khalil is released when his case moves through the courts, but also acknowledges that this administration has a different strategy. She warns not everyone arrested under these terms will have legal representation.
There may be some pressure on individuals who are in this situation, to voluntarily give up their permanent residency rather than going through this kind of more convoluted and more difficult process.
Bailey warns that some people who may not understand the system may just lose their status.
And just briefly, walk us through how this fits into President Trump's wider efforts to increase deportations.
One pillar of the administration's plan has been to revoke the legal status of people already in the country. And we've already seen this through the rescission of certain protected statuses and cancellation of programs. That's threatening to leave without status hundreds of thousands of people who came to the U.S. via legal programs. But increasing the number of people who are deportable does not actually mean more deportations. The legal fight can take years, and it's a logistical lift, an expensive endeavor to gather people and send them out on a plane. Uh-huh. Both Immigration and Customs Enforcement and immigration courts have long been underfunded and under-resourced. Still, lawyers and those on Columbia's campus worry about a chilling effect that this might have on many things, from free speech to engaging with law enforcement and seeking benefits.
That is NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you.
Thank you.
One way to tell that spring is arriving: the familiar songs of birds. But birds can change their tunes as their populations evolve. At least that's what researchers at the University of Oxford have observed by studying
a specific species of bird that is very common, the great tit.
The great tit. That's the common name for the species Parus major. Outside of Oxford, there is a forest full of birdhouses where scientists have studied these birds for nearly eight decades. One such researcher is Nilo Marino Ricalde.
They are quite happy to breed in nest boxes, and this makes it a lot easier to monitor their life cycle.
For the past 3 years, there's been a new addition to the nest boxes, microphones. Marina Ricalde recorded the birds every morning.
I think it was around 21,000 hours of audio, so that's like over a year and a half of continuous audio recordings.
AI has made combing through that kind of data possible. Marino Ricalde wanted to know why bird songs change over time. He found the age of birds is quite important.
Older birds remember the songs that were popular when they were young, and younger ones can learn the oldies from elders. Groups of just young birds tend to prefer simple songs.
Kind of teacher songs that sound a bit like...
Another factor is how far the birds traveled.
Specifically, we see that the more birds move around within a population, the more likely they are to end up singing common songs.
Nilo Marino Ricalde says one way to think about this is they find new pop songs as they travel, but he says they also introduce the songs that are common back home.
His team's research has been published in the journal Current Biology. And while the bird microphones are off for now, he hopes other researchers will study the greatest hits of the great tits of Oxford.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Dow closed down almost 900 points today, ending another brutal day on Wall Street. Investors are worried about the impact of President Trump's tariffs and about a possible recession. So how worried should consumers be about what's next for the economy? Maria Aspen is NPR's financial correspondent. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Ari.
Just to start with the stock market, what's the latest?
So the stock market has been up and down, but mostly down since early last week when President Trump's new tariffs went into effect. Then Trump gave a few temporary reprieves to automakers in Mexico and Canada, but all the whiplash spooked investors who are worried that tariffs could eventually hurt the broader economy. And then yesterday, Fox News aired an interview with Trump that got everyone more worried. Fox News anchor Maria Bartiromo asked Trump this.
Are you expecting a recession this year?
I hate to predict things like that. There is a period of transition because what we're doing is very big. We're bringing wealth back to America. That's a big thing.
So how significant is it that he did not rule out the possibility of a recession there?
Well, it seems significant today. Now, I should note Trump's Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, did tell NBC News in a different interview yesterday that, quote, there's no chance of a recession. But today, Wall Street seemed to be listening to Trump more than Lutnick.
So how concerned should people be that tariffs might spark a recession?
Well, one of the big concerns over tariffs is that they could really hike the prices consumers pay for everything from cars to groceries. That'll contribute to inflation and hurt the wider economy. We've seen companies, including Target and Best Buy, warn that tariffs will lead to higher prices. So that's a huge consideration for consumers and for consumer-facing businesses.
And of course, the stock market is not the same as the economy, but how much of a warning sign is the drop in the markets that we're seeing right now?
Right. Well, any one day in the markets is pretty ephemeral. Tomorrow, something could happen that sparks a rally. And we should note that some of the worst losses today were among tech stocks, which have also been the hottest and thus the most overvalued. But there are a couple of longer-term trends I'm watching here. For all businesses, there's been so much back and forth that it creates a lot of volatility. And for consumers and businesses alike, that volatility makes it hard to plan. There's also just there had been some lingering doubt about whether Trump is serious about the tariffs or just using them as a negotiating tactic. Now it increasingly seems like he might really be serious. And maybe, as Trump promises, there will be long-term gains. But as many experts are warning, there will also be some immediate pain.
That's NPR's Maria Aspen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Syria is still struggling 3 months after its revolution. There are glimmers of hope. At one hotel, hundreds of people recently gathered to talk about jumpstarting the country's tech industry, which was virtually non-existent during Syria's civil war. One young man fled that war as a teenager. He returned as a Stanford grad student and a budding entrepreneur. NPR's Greg Myrie has the story from the capital, Damascus, and a warning, this piece does include descriptions of torture and abuse.
Some 700 people, most from Syria and some from the U.S., filled a ballroom at the Sheraton Hotel in Damascus for the tech conference dubbed Silicon Valley in Syria.
Everyone was here and everyone is excited. Everyone, like, you know, this excitement of like, hey, we want to build, we want to do something for our country. We're so happy.
Abdul Wahab Omira is a young Syrian American who took a break from his master's program at Stanford to attend. Like everyone at the conference, he acknowledged the staggering challenges after 14 years of civil war.
There's no infrastructure. There is no electricity. There is no water. There is no internet. Showering is an event.
Omira says his own experience taught him resilience, and he believes many Syrians have learned the same lesson. As a teenager in Damascus, he studied the high cancer rates in an area where the Syrian government disposed of nuclear waste. He proposed a new method and was awarded a patent at age 14 and was supposed to be honored at the presidential palace. But before that happened, he was stopped one day by the security forces. They found documents related to the nuclear program, and O'Meara was tossed in prison. The experience was harrowing.
They start bringing people in, killing them under torture, showing me how they kill them. And each room has a different theme of killing. So many horrible stuff, room number 3, for example, they killed people with like a chainsaw.
O'Meara was not physically harmed, but he was warned that if he was arrested again,
you will choose one of those rooms to die in.
O'Meara was released after 2 months, and his family decided it was time to leave Syria. They went from a prosperous life in Damascus to a tent in a refugee camp in neighboring Turkey. Eventually, they made it to the U.S., landing in Chicago. But O'Meara didn't speak English or have a valid high school diploma. He kept studying till he got a perfect score on the college entrance exam and admission to Stanford University. He graduated with a computer science degree last year. He's now in the master's program working on artificial intelligence. He also runs a tech startup designed to help farmers in Syria. And he's meeting with tech students throughout the country.
We went to 7 universities across Syria where we give workshops for the students.
Still, the obstacles in Syria can seem endless. U.S. sanctions remain. They were imposed against Syria's dictator, Bashar al-Assad, and though he was ousted 3 months ago, the sanctions have not been lifted. This was a recurring theme at the tech conference. Organizer Rama Shikaki is a Syrian-American and a tech investor from California.
Absolutely. So the sanctions now are quite prohibitive. I mean, the banking system is disconnected from the rest of the world. And so folks like me can never invest in Syria until these sanctions are lifted.
For now, the goal is to connect Syria's tech community, which was so isolated during the war.
One thing about Syrians is we're very socially interconnected. All of us, having been in the diaspora, feeling very displaced, couldn't wait for that chance to get together. So my 12,000 connections on LinkedIn worked really well for me.
When Abdul Wahab O'Meara returned to Syria, he visited his old family home.
I went to my room. I was digging out my memories, and then I found my first CS book, computer science book, that I got in seventh grade. They were explaining what the internet is, how to use the keyboard, how to turn off the PC.
O'Meara has come a long way since then. He summed up his journey from refugee to Stanford student to tech entrepreneur this way.
The U.S. was definitely the land of opportunity, because if you put 100%, you get 100%. In Turkey, if you put 100%, you probably get 10%. Here, if you put 100%, you get in prison.
He's hoping to write a new formula for a new Syria. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Damascus.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
This is NPR News.
The American auto industry has been hit hard by the threat of tariffs. Stocks have been falling since President Donald Trump announced plans for tariffs on Mexico, China, and Canada. Tesla's stock has seen an even steeper decline than most car manufacturers. So what's driving Tesla's downturn? That's the story tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, we'll look at one solution to a growing problem of suicide attempts among Black adolescents.
It's a program that partners clergy with mental health professionals.
And then when we started getting calls about suicide attempts, I was like, oh, this is really bad.
That's coming up after the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. NASA has laid off its chief scientist, as NPR's Jeff Brumfield tells us. Her position was deemed redundant as part of larger staffing cuts at the agency.
Dr. Kate Calvin had served as NASA's chief scientist since 2022. Her job was to advise senior leadership on the space agency's many scientific missions. She also served as the agency's senior advisor on climate change and was a leading government climate scientist. Calvin was one of 23 employees at NASA who lost their jobs, according to a statement from the agency. Others worked in the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. The space agency says it plans more layoffs in the near future to comply with an executive order from President Trump. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News, Washington.
The new district attorney of Los Angeles County says he won't support resentencing the Menendez brothers because he says they lied about shooting their parents in self-defense more than 35 years ago. DA Nathan Hochman says Lyle and Eric Menendez repeatedly lied about why they killed their parents at their Beverly Hills home. And he opposes a new trial for the brothers who are serving life without the possibility of parole. Hochman says he doesn't believe the brothers meet the resentencing threshold.
The district attorney's office, if it is presented with these new insights, unequivocal, sincere acknowledgments of all the lies they have told for the past over 30 years, we too, in the district attorney's office, will reconsider whether or not we would want to go forward with a resentencing motion.
But Hochman says Governor Gavin Newsom has the ultimate authority over whether the Menendez brothers should be freed. Stocks finished sharply lower on Wall Street over concerns about higher inflation and the uncertainty of what more Trump tariffs will do to the U.S. economy. This is NPR. Scientists have developed a system that restores a sense of touch as well as movement to people living with paralysis. NPR's John Hamilton has the story.
The system uses a brain-computer interface and artificial intelligence to bypass the damaged part of a patient's spine. That allows signals from the motor area of the brain to control the muscles in a person's hand. Keith Thomas, who is paralyzed from the chest down from a diving accident, says it also sends signals to his brain from sensors on his hand.
They hooked me up to the machine and, like, this is the first time I felt my index finger. I was like, whoa.
The system also stimulates the spinal cord when signals are going in either direction. This strengthens the remaining natural connections between the brain and body, even when a person isn't connected to the computer interface. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Well, scientists say climate change could soon cause problems well beyond Earth, creating a mess for orbiting satellites. Researchers at MIT say the long-term impacts of global warming could reduce the available space for satellites because climate change makes the upper atmosphere cooler and less dense. The scientists say that means more space junk because dead satellites and debris won't fall to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 890 points today, down more than 2%. The tech-heavy NASDAQ was down 4%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. On Tuesday in Saudi Arabia, Ukrainian officials will meet with the U.S. delegation, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio, to try to find a framework for a potential ceasefire agreement with Russia. These talks come 10 days after President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance scolded Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky at a meeting in the Oval Office. After that meeting, Trump accused Zelensky of not being ready for peace. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley is in Ukraine, and she's been talking to people about what kind of deal they envision.
Dmytro and Olena Reifschneider are waiting for their bus in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv. The young couple says they still can't get over the White House meeting that seemed to show their longtime U.S. ally turn against them and let Russian President Vladimir Putin off the hook.
We are shocked, yes, and I don't understand if it's a part of a big plan or it's really what it seems to be, what it seems like, and I don't know what to expect.
Of course, we want peace very much, yes, but for us it's very painful to hear that
it's our fault
because it's Ukraine not is... our fault. We want to live in our country and to live like we want to live in our society, but and without Russia, without their politics.
The couple says these last years have proven that Russians and Ukrainians are very different people. They can't imagine living under what they call Putin's brutal dictatorship. The Oval Office quarrel also shook up Europe, which has now pledged over $800 billion to build up European defense and provide immediate military support for Ukraine after Washington suspended aid. French President Emmanuel Macron said there could be no lasting peace if Ukraine is abandoned.
La Russie est devenue, au moment où je vous parle, et pour les années.
Russia has become and will be for years to come a threat to France and Europe, he said. The heads of European militaries are gathering in Paris tomorrow to discuss keeping the peace in Ukraine once the fighting stops. Britain and France have pledged to be the backbone of such a force. But the Kremlin has said sending troops from any NATO country into Ukraine is crossing a red line. And when it comes to ceasefire talks, it's easy to see other possible sticking points when you talk to Ukrainians.
We have to bring first truth here. We have to name the aggressor.
That's Taras Yatsenko, the founder of an independent media house. He says for a real peace, you need justice, or at a minimum, truth.
And if we want to make it never happen again, it means that, really, Russia must be defeated.
Though he admits he is worried after the recent statements and actions of President Trump. I ask him if Ukrainians will accept freezing the conflict lines where they are, for now, he says, but not indefinitely.
They can't be recognized as officially Russian territories because they are Ukrainian. That's a sovereign Ukrainian territory.
Putin has said all territories controlled by Russia now will remain Russian and even claims other areas as belonging to Russia. Thousands of Ukrainian flags whip in the wind at a military cemetery where 28-year-old Alina Zaitseva has just visited her young husband's grave. I ask what kind of peace she imagines. I don't want us to negotiate with Russia at all, she says. My husband died fighting for us to live on our land. What they are proposing now is horrifying. Zaitseva fears the U.S. will force Ukraine to capitulate. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Lviv.
Mental well-being has been a big concern for adolescents in recent years. Experts have sounded alarms about an increase in suicide risk for Black teens. NPR's Katie Riddle visited one church in New York pioneering a novel approach to helping kids improve their mental health. And a warning, this story does discuss suicide.
The staff at First Corinthian Baptist Church in Harlem felt they had no choice. They had to tackle this issue.
just the amount of phone calls we were getting.
Lena Green is a social worker. She runs the program for teens at the church. This was a few years ago. At the time, they were providing mental health services for adults, but not for children.
I was probably getting almost 10 calls a week asking for services for teens.
She kept referring them out to programs and therapists, but families kept coming back, telling her they couldn't get in. Many were in crisis.
And then when we started getting calls about suicide attempts, I was like, oh, this is really bad.
Research shows the suicide rate among Black teens rising in recent years. One study showed it increased by 144% between 2007 and 2020. One goal of this program is to help kids recognize a mental health crisis or prevent it altogether. On this day, a 16-year-old teenager named Janelle Davis dropped by to see Green after school. They're chatting in a community room.
Did you have soda today?
Healthy eating is one thing they've been talking about lately.
No.
What? No soda?
No.
What? Yes. Okay.
Janelle is doing well now, but a couple of years ago, she was going through a rough time.
I think, like, I just started, like, isolating myself from people.
It was a tough moment for her family. Her parents were divorcing. She says watching her mom struggle, she didn't want to burden her with anything else.
I feel like we weren't talking to each other on an emotional level. Like, we weren't, like, really emotionally honest.
She started to have some very dark thoughts, thoughts about hurting herself. Luckily, she had already started working with Green. She felt comfortable talking to her. Green remembers some of the conversations they had during this time.
We talk a lot about having lots of negative thoughts and, you know, negative voices sort of in our head, right? About whether or not we're worthy, right? Whether or not we should live or die.
Green also placed an important phone call to Janelle's mom, Sertina Robinson. Sitting in the church recently, Robinson remembers the day she got that call.
I ran over here from the Bronx, and that's the first time I heard that she was having struggles with her mental health.
Robinson was a newly single mom of four kids holding down a job as an assistant principal. She says she just hadn't seen the crisis in front of her.
Dr. Green just kept reiterating, we want her to live. We want her to be happy. We want her to thrive. And I remember she told me, you know, because this happened. We got her help.
Robinson credits the church, this program, and Green with saving her daughter's life.
She helped her by giving her, like, something to look forward to in the future.
First Corinthian Baptist is now participating in a pilot program to reduce suicide risk for teens. It's one of 16 churches around the country. The program helps kids focus on things like kindness and purpose. Sherry Mollick is a researcher at George Washington University. She designed this study. They're currently evaluating its impact.
We chose Black churches intentionally because we know the Black churches are a trusted institution.
Mollick says working through the church allows them to focus not just on the kids, but the whole family.
We know that they are really poised to help reduce stigma around mental health challenges in general and suicide in particular.
Normalizing these conversations, says Sherry Mollick, can make the difference between life and death. Katie Arendt, NPR News, Harlem.
Anyone in crisis can call or text 988. Just those three numbers, 988, for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Perhaps you remember the underdog story of the Jamaican bobsled team at the 1988 Calgary Olympics. Perhaps you at least remember the Hollywood movie it inspired.
Feel the rhythm. Feel the rhyme. Get on up. It's bobsled time. Cool Runnings.
3 decades after the film Cool Runnings, a new generation of Jamaican bobsledders is starting to ascend the sport's international rankings. They want to win Jamaica's first Winter Olympic medal. North Country Public Radio's David Escobar reports.
Before that first Olympic race in 1988, the Jamaican bobsled team had just 6 months of training and barely enough money to get by. They practiced at the former Olympic complex in Lake Placid with their coach Pat Brown, using a four-man sled patched together with duct tape. Brown says the venue didn't have a proper track to practice sled launches, so he had to get creative.
So the only thing I could come up with, I borrowed a buddy's truck and we took our foreman down to the toboggan chute on the ice there, and we were pushing on the lake.
Brown's memories of the team pushing sleds across a frozen lake are a far cry from today's Jamaican bobsleigh squad. Since arriving to Lake Placid in January, they've been digging their cleats into a state-of-the-art indoor bobsled track. That's where road manager Audra Segri watches team members dressed in sleek black race suits push a training sled along an icy track.
I would say I like where the program is heading. Granted, we have a lot to work on, but it's good to say we have a start.
The Jamaican team's goal is to win an Olympic medal within the next 10 years. Getting there requires experience and qualification points at events like this North American Cup race in Lake Placid.
Sled in from start one. This is Shane Pitter and Tyreek Buckner of Team Jamaica.
Tyreek Buckner is the brakeman for the team's two-man sled. Like many of his teammates, Buckner didn't grow up bobsledding. He transitioned to the sport from football 2 years ago. He says it's hard to fit training in with the rest of his life, and he's still learning the technique. He's also adjusting to Lake Placid's frigid weather, which, like bobsled, doesn't happen in his home country.
I remember when I had to come here, I had to tell people, like, hey, I can't come in for a certain amount of months because I have to do bobsledding in Jamaica. And it's like, I don't believe you. You have to show proof of that. You know?
The Olympic Sports Complex in Lake Placid is 1,800 miles away from Jamaica, but it's still the program's closest option for training. It's become a second home for generations of Jamaican bobsledders. When they're not racing or practicing, team members like 17-year-old Adonna Johnson hang out in a small warehouse to tune up the metal runners underneath their sleds. Johnson competed for Jamaica in the Youth Winter Games just over a year ago. She says her hope is to establish herself at the professional level.
It's really good because this is a sport where you can like stay in it for a while before you have to retire with them. So I'm really grateful that I can start at such a young age to progress.
Top finishes move the Jamaican team up the rankings and closer to their Olympic dreams. Sled pilot Shane Pitter says they're aiming high.
And we want to do well in the Olympics so they could even build another cool running too. Like, we are the dream team now.
For NPR News, I'm David Escobar in Lake Placid, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has pledged to purge conflicts of interest from the government agencies that fall under Health and Human Services. In his confirmation hearings, he took aim at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Advisory Committee on Vaccines. He cited an old government report that 97% of CDC advisors had conflicts of interest. Public health advocates think Kennedy might be laying the groundwork to kick members off the vaccine committee. NPR's Ping Huang has looked into Kennedy's claim.
The claim dates back to a 50-page report from late 2009. It's from the Office of Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services. It audited ethics paperwork filed in 2007, and it covers all 17 CDC advisory committees at the time, which gave guidance on topics from smoking to improving clinical labs. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices was one of them. Dr. Dale Morse chaired that committee from 2007 to 2009.
Based on my other presence on other committees, I would think that ACIP would have been the most complete.
That's Morse's impression, but the report doesn't mention specific committees. What it does say, looking at all the committees, is that 97% of these long financial disclosure forms that people submitted had some kind of error or omission on them. Morse, now retired from CDC's Food Safety Unit, remembers those forms.
It was like do your taxes, but worse, you had to actually list every single category that was listed in that portfolio.
The errors and omissions include things like people putting the right information in the wrong part of the form, or reviewers forgetting to initial or date the pages. The report also faulted CDC for not identifying potential conflicts of interest for 58% of committee members. The agency said then that it would go beyond the form to collect information on conflicts, but that the report overstated the problem. Dr. Carol Baker chaired the Vaccine Advisory Committee after Morse from 2009 to 2012.
I believe that the report is accurate, but when you get down there to things that might have been a problem, it's down to 3%.
That 3% represents the proportion of all CDC committee members who voted on issues they were supposed to recuse themselves from in 2007. That is a problem, and the Office of Inspector General investigated these cases. But they determined that these were not criminal violations, but mistakes stemming from CDC's lack of oversight at the time. Baker, a vaccine researcher who recently retired from UT Health Houston Medical School, says on the Vaccine Advisory Committee, the rules were strict. She saw it firsthand.
My first meeting, first day, new voting member, this was 2006.
She remembers it clearly. About an hour or two into the public meeting, a CDC staffer came into the room and demanded that Baker leave with her immediately.
She said, I'm from legal. Dr. Baker has a serious conflict, and she's been asked to leave. Well, this was a clerical error.
They sorted it out, she stayed, and went on to serve for 6 years. But the fact that she was almost kicked out of her first meeting because CDC staff thought there was a conflict of interest, Baker says they took these things very seriously. That rigor extended to every public meeting.
At the beginning of the meeting, when everybody's saying who they are, they say no conflicts. And every time there's a vote, they have to say no conflicts.
Or in those cases when members have a conflict, they recuse themselves from the discussion and the vote. These public meeting declarations are now compiled on a list on the CDC website, an initiative of Kennedy's to increase transparency. Dr. Tom Frieden was CDC director when the report came out. He signed the agency's response letter at the time, agreeing with most of its findings.
So it is important to avoid impropriety and the appearance of impropriety. It is important that any potential conflict of interest that may unduly influence a recommendation be investigated.
But he says now Kennedy is misusing the report, claiming it shows conflicts of interest in a specific committee when it does not. Frieden calls it classic misinformation.
Right now, all we're getting is a total misrepresentation of a 20-year-old report about a process that was already being improved before that report was issued.
In response to a request for comment, a spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services said Kennedy is committed to ensuring radical transparency across HHS. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from listener Ellen Wyoming Deloy. About 15 years ago, Ellen was in grad school in Portland, Oregon. She regularly used that city's light rail system as part of her commute back and forth to class. One night, she was one of just a few people on the train as she headed home.
And I remember when I got off at my exit, I was one of very few, if not the only person, to get off at the station. The station bears noting in that it was a little bit of an enclosed space. And when you got off the platform, you would have to walk up a set of stairs to get to street level. And so I was just walking and I noted no one else around me. And as I'm ascending the steps, I get about halfway up, and then the train, which usually just does a short ring to indicate that the train is about to depart the station, started to do a really violent, persistent, ongoing ring, like as if someone were banging a doorbell 20 times in a row. And it finally made me stop because it was so strange. And I stopped and I turned and I looked. And at about the same time, I saw two things. The first I saw was the train driver, who I could see was looking at me with kind of an intense urgency. And right then, behind me, ascending the steps, but at that point, turning and running in the other direction, was a lone man. I don't know what would have happened that night if the train driver hadn't caught my attention. But somebody was pursuing me for whatever, probably not good intention. And I just remembered thinking, what a gift. What a gift to have had this person pause just long enough to notice that this didn't look quite right. And he waited to save me from whatever harm may have been coming. I made it home safe that night. I never had another issue. But I've always thought about that train conductor and how one evening, he helped save a passenger, someone in his community, and he made it safer for me. So I really thank him.
Ellen Wyoming Deloy of Hillsboro, Oregon. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at zquil.com. From Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. And from the John D.